People don't realize this, but dads are really, really, really important in kids' emotional regulation. So if you engage with your kids, believe it or not, it's probably the most therapeutic thing dads can do. Now, every day, some guy comes home, thousands of men come home every day, and their wives are like, hey, let me tell you what happened. And all they're trying to say to you is, I need you to relate to me right now. I need you to feel what I'm feeling and connect on a spiritual level, right? But men step in it every day because they're like, oh, I know what to do. When we get in our head and we get too analytical about our performance in any facet of life, that's actually when we do the worst. All right, welcome to the Rad Dad Podcast. This is episode 28. I have Spencer Cooper here. My best friend referred to you. So he's told me a lot about you. I have a lot of curiosity in what you do and the knowledge you're going to share. So
great.
Thanks for being on. Just to start off, tell me a little bit about like your childhood, your upbringing, and maybe some highlights from that time.
All right. I grew up north of Salt Lake in Kingsville, about 30 minutes up the freeway. Lived in the same place my entire life until my mission when I was 19. So I grew up with a brother that was 6 years older than me and four sisters. So I'm five of six siblings, four sisters and me and my brother. Went to Davis High. Highlights of growing up, man. I mean, I had one of those childhoods that was, I feel like, completely non-existent anymore, where your parents allow you to run wild and like run around with all your buddies. There were no fences. We lived in a kind of a newer development and nobody had ever, you know, it was new enough that no one had put up any fences. And so like everyone's yard just kind of bled into each other. And it was like soccer 1 second, football the next, basketball. And it was just, there was like a boy that lived in almost every single house of that street. And we all just became really tight. So grew up just hanging up. I think my favorite thing was just going outside and playing street hockey or whatever. Again, the street was new enough. There wasn't a lot of traffic on it. So we played a lot of sports. But aside from that, my family life, I suppose my favorite thing was we always went up. We had a couple of grandparents that one lived down in Cedar City, southern Utah. And my other grandparents lived up in Canada. My mom's Canadian.
Okay.
And so we would always take the long trek up to Canada or the shorter trek down to southern Utah, but made those trips probably each once a year.
Okay.
And I don't know, learned a lot from my grandparents. My grandpa was a Christmas tree farmer and shepherd.
Wow.
So he had sheep in the summers and he harvested Christmas trees in the fall up in British Columbia, Canada. And that was awesome to learn from him and all his experience. But then my other grandparents were completely opposite. They were the educated type. My grandpa was a professor at SUU in geology, and my grandma, she was the special collections librarian, helped actually start the Shakespearean Festival down in Cedar City that a lot of people know today, but back then it was just teeny. So yeah, it's great childhood. I feel like I had came from a relatively functional family. And I say that now because I've studied family life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to see the holes when you're up close, but honestly, I shouldn't speak any ill. It's an incredible family. My parents are still married. That's saying a lot. I don't have any divorced siblings, which is statistically amazing. And it's a pretty tight-knit family. So can't complain. I had a great family growing up. We actually took on, I guess the highlight of my childhood really was taking on my parents took on two, we call them our brother and sister, but they were our neighbor's children when their mom died.
Wow.
A buddy my age, whose name actually ironically is Spencer as well, he was about 18 months when his mom died in a car wreck, and his older sister was like four. And so their dad, being a busy real estate attorney, gone every day till at least seven or eight, she just took them in every day. So they'd go to, she'd get up, get them ready for school. They'd come in the morning really early. They'd go to school with us all day, picked up with us, hung out at our house till 8 or 9 and then go home.
Wow.
And that was, I never thought twice about it until I was much older, but they really became like brothers and sisters to us. And him and I formed a really oddly close relationship because it wasn't, I would never call him my friend, but yeah. I can't exactly call him my brother either.
What's the age gap?
Between him and I?
Yeah.
Oh gosh, 6 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm October, he's April. So
wow.
We were in the same grade and everything.
So you literally grew up together.
Yeah. It was kind of like, it was like having a twin that you didn't really
yeah.
have. You
know? Yeah.
But it was awesome. A really interesting dynamic because him and I would often talk about what it meant. I mean, at a really young age to have parents, just because for him, that was something he was always dealing with emotionally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I guess maybe that set the stage for why I went into it later in life.
Yeah. That was kind of my question. I was going to leave is that kind of why you chose, you want to talk about your career path and what led to where you are now?
Yeah. So I'm a chaplain for the, I'm endorsed by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but I'm a chaplain for the Utah State Hospital in Provo. And I help endorse chaplains of the church. Chaplains, for people who don't know, are an odd breed where you represent religious freedom and religious worship rights for all faiths, regardless of religious background. And you're trained in world religions so that you can do counseling, pastoral counseling for any and all faiths. But specifically, you run the services and make sure that everybody, no matter what their faith background is getting the religious supervision and religious provision that they need. So I do that for the hospital, on the state hospital. I've done it now for 12 years for the military, in the Navy and in the Air Force. And I currently have a position in the church where in Salt Lake, it's called Military Relations. I manage the Military Relations Division for the church, which is essentially the division that endorses chaplains for the church.
Okay.
So that's more recent, but up until last year, I had full-time hospital chaplain. So a lot of counseling with people of other faiths, but a lot of family stuff because working in a hospital and working with the Air Force for the last decade and the Navy before that, you run into a lot of family situations. So the Air Force, the Navy, the Army, they don't have family therapists. So it all really falls in those branches of service. It falls to the chaplain to be kind of the first responder for family issues. And then if they need something more long-term, you kind of get them connected with what they need. But
so does it fall under the therapy canopy?
It does.
Okay.
I wouldn't say it falls under the, like, if you're thinking of psychotherapy or like a more clinical therapy, but it is certainly all of our trainings, all of our annual continuing education credits, it's all done with all those types.
Okay.
And we take social work and all that stuff. So it's where religion meets social work is what I like to call it, because you have to have a counseling experience and the counseling credits. You've got to have a master's degree to do it.
Okay.
But your focus is on helping people apply their religious beliefs to their therapy.
Okay.
So kind of a...
That brought it all together in my mind.
Yeah.
That completely makes sense.
Yep.
Was there a moment in your life that made you, that had you make this decision, like, that's what I want to be?
Yeah, I guess a few. My first experience with chaplaincy was just from enlisting in the Marine Corps after 9/11. When I got home from my mission, 9/11 had just taken place. The country was obviously changed by it. It was kind of a shock for me to get home into that environment. And we just started the war in Iraq, and I felt like, you know, you get home from doing 2 years of service for other people, thinking about other people, and
yeah,
it was kind of like, what can I do here? You know, life kind of becomes self-centered after that.
Yeah.
You're going to college for you, dating girls for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, but what can I do that's kind of bigger than this? And I realized that joining the military would be something I could do. I was really naive. I had no idea what I was doing. I don't come from like a long line of military mm-hmm. family. But I asked my dad, like, how would you go about doing this? And he's like, well, I guess you'd go to one of those recruiting stations in the strip malls that you see all the time. And I literally just walked into the first one I saw, which happened to be the Marine Corps, and said, hey, I want to be a soldier. And he's like, you mean a Marine? And I'm like, sure, whatever that is. But man, had I known better, I probably wouldn't have started off with that one. But it was amazing because since that's what I did when I was deployed for the first time in 2003, after like my year of training, it was, man, like that was the first time, you know, you see a lot of stuff and you get debriefed by chaplains and you realize that they kind of run the services. But frankly, I personally, growing up as a Latter-day Saint, like I didn't know my faith even had chaplains. I didn't realize that we had such a thing. I thought you had to be a Catholic priest or something.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know about it either.
Yeah, it's a lot of people don't. So it was years later. I deployed twice during that time and then got out of the Marine Corps in 07, came back to study family life here. But to answer the question, I think those moments that I was with my buddies in the Marine Corps, and they'd come back from deployment, and it was so strange to me. My wife and I, like every time I'd come home, her and I got closer and closer and closer. But every time most of my buddies got home, like we watched them struggle, and yeah. A lot of them got divorced. A lot of them, one of them took their life. Like a lot of them would start drinking really heavily, and you could tell they were all coping in really more destructive ways. And I felt like my relationship was kind of like a saving grace, you know?
Yeah.
It made me more and more like committed to that relationship. And so that got me thinking, like, how do relationships affect some people some ways and other people others?
Right.
So that was when I kind of decided I want to study families. Maybe I'll do family therapy. But still hadn't really thought about chaplaincy. And then I got back here when I was checking out of my base. You have to check out at the chaplain's office in the military because they're just like making sure everything's good at home and you have no final like complaints or problems that later they'll have to pay for through the VA or something. Mm-hmm. So you're going to check out, and I met this chaplain. He was super, super interested in my life, and I thought, this is strange. But I learned later, obviously, that he had seen that I was going to BYU, or that when I told him that was what I'm going to do, and he saw I was an 801 area code. So he started asking a lot of questions. Turns out he was an LDS chaplain, and I didn't even know him, but he was one of the chaplains on my base. And a couple months later, he was called to serve as a mission president when he was retiring. He was a really old guy. And I guess he said, hey, there's this guy going to study family life at BYU, and he was a Marine, and that's not a common combination.
Yeah. So he knew you were...
That's right.
So you were going to study that without the intention of being chaplain?
No,
yet.
No. See, I didn't know my faith had chaplains. I didn't even know he was an mm-hmm. chaplain.
Okay.
I didn't know. So as it turns out, kind of from name drop, he dropped that name just because it just happened and we just met.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was called just a few months later and retired. So he was like, hey, you should call the guy. So the military relations department of the church, which again, some people don't know we even have, but somebody from that office called me and said, hey, you know, we heard you're going to BYU. We heard you're studying family life, mm-hmm. interested in kind of counseling, but just got out of the Marine Corps, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah. And I'm thinking, that's kind of creepy that you know that, you know? That was my first response. And then they just said, we wonder if you've ever considered chaplaincy. And I was like, I'm not Catholic. You know, like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
This is a strange question. And they said, no, actually, we have a program at BYU. It's a master's program. You got to get some related counseling credits, like you're doing it first in your undergrad, and then you can go on to do master's of counseling and chaplaincy.
Okay.
And that's how I got into it. So it was a long, odd journey. There were times I thought, what am I doing? And then, but to be honest, if there was one moment, it was really when I was studying family therapy, because what occurred to me deeply was like, whatever you want to call it, you know, and every person calls it something different. The human spirit is probably the most common name for it. Like, we address the mind really well now, and we're all comfortable talking about brain stuff. Finally, which, by the way, wasn't even true like 50 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Like, no one wanted to talk about that.
You're talking about like mental health.
Yeah, mental stuff. Health and stuff.
Yeah.
But we were okay talking about emotional stuff finally too.
Yeah.
But nobody wants to talk about meaning. Like, where meaning derives from. Mm-hmm. What really truly gets us going every day, and what motivates us. Not from a psychological perspective, but from like a why a child means so much to us when they're born perspective.
Okay.
Like, where we all derive that deep sense of meaning
yeah.
from. And to me now, that's my definition of spirituality. It's not religiosity. It's not how often you go to church or read your scriptures or say your prayers. It's this deep sense of spiritual wellness that you get up every day with some real meaning in your life. Mm-hmm. That you want to do something that gives you fulfillment in a deep way. Or that you feel like you're engaged in doing something that does give you fulfillment in a deep way. Those people are spiritually well. And we just don't, even though that's the most important thing on like every self-report survey ever done, there's just hardly any field that addresses that head on. We're fine addressing our physical bodies, our brains now, and our emotions, but like, we're not very good at addressing meaning in people's lives. So I guess what attracted to me was like when I realized there was no space for that in family therapy. It was kind of like, here's some models you can follow. Here's family systems theory. Here's this REBT, CBT, all this stuff we're going through, but nothing truly like got people talking about what mattered to them and why it mattered. And that was when I started to realize like people's faith, their spirituality, that's where that lives, is in that place of like their beliefs. Like, what do they really believe about the world and what's going on and what they're doing here and why? And it doesn't even matter what, you know, it never has mattered to me much. I guess naturally, I just have always felt like, of course, people from other faiths have just as much meaning as I have from my faith. I've always taken that for granted. But like, why we all cling to faith in some way, shape or form, why we all gravitate towards some deep set of beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm interested in.
Okay.
And that's where my counseling really goes. And that's what I do with people when I see them in my office. So it's a form of therapy that to me kind of gets right to the heart of what gets people going or what's not working in their life. And I feel like it just cuts through a lot of, not that all that is not important, but it's a long way of getting there. And jumping right to the spirituality and the meaning is a short way of getting there.
So from your perspective and your experience, do the majority of people have meaning in their lives or not have meaning?
Oh man, we are in a crisis of meaning right now. I think everybody has seen that. We don't know what to call it. And a lot of times we make it out simply to blanket statements, say mental health. But what we're really in a crisis of meaning, what everyone truly is, I mean, I think nothing has shown that more poignantly than social media,
mm-hmm.
that there's this huge crisis to be understood as a human being, to be connected. And in the name of social connection and like, here, look, we have all these social media things that you can be connected. You got your cell phone. We've actually disconnected spiritually from one another.
It's the most disconnecting thing there is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it is the deception of all deceptions. I always remind my kids all the time, when I'm talking about technology, and by the way, I come from a, just so you know, I'm not like anti-tech. My dad is a tech guy and he was an innovator his whole life and loves computers and wrote software and computer programs and even sold some that he created. So I come from a family that's well versed in technology. But that being said, maybe that's why I've ever since I was young realized like, but it can also be really dangerous.
Yeah.
And we just do it because we figure out we can. And nobody has ever stopped to really say like, but should we be doing it? Is it actually healthier for the soul of mankind to be doing this all day long or to be allowing our kids access to it at such a young age? So I always remind my kids every day, the meaning of virtual. Almost every day, at some point, I find some way to say to them, remember what virtual means. Fake.
Yeah.
That's all it means. It's not real. Hmm. So while that's a great way to disseminate information, it's not a great way to have a real connection. It's not a great way to have a real relationship. And the more time you spend in the fake world of relationships, the less fulfillment you're going to have in the real world of relationships.
Yeah.
And we've just substituted that time. We've just flopped it. We used to spend this much time, you know, in real relationships and this much time in the tech world. Now we spend this much time in the tech world and this much time in our real relationships. And, you know, you get what you get after a while. And I think we owe it to ourselves to kind of wake up and say, hey, yeah, why are we allowing that tech to drive our lives the way that it does? We should be using it for all its great purposes, dissemination of information and ability to communicate and predict amazing things like weather and medical outcomes and all the things that it can do that help mankind. But mm-hmm. we really let it dominate our social lives, our emotional lives, and most importantly now, it's gotten down into our spiritual wellness. And to me, that's where we really either have to regulate it to some degree. Speaking of regulation with AI and everything that's coming out now, here we go, right?
Yeah.
Now we won't even know the difference between fake and real. I mean, imagine how that's going to affect us.
Right? Yeah, like it's scary to think about.
Yep.
But this has been a topic on several times on the podcast, you know, tech and how we handle that with our children and the impact of it. And I feel like we really don't know the full consequences. And the only way to measure it is time.
Yeah.
And then let's wait 20 years and see when the iPad kids are having kids.
That's right.
You know, and it's so scary.
The problem with that is as soon as you realize the problem, it's too late.
Right.
You're now completely doing patchwork. You know, you got this ship that's sinking. You're patching holes.
Yeah.
What's the likelihood you're not going to sink?
You know? Yeah. So I have a 3-year-old toddler, a 3-year-old boy, and a 3-week-old girl. What can I do as a dad to make sure they have that human connection, not just in the family, but outside of the family?
So one of my favorite studies ever done on families was done by, among others, lots of people at Brigham Young University, especially headed up for a time by Randall Day, Dr. Day, who actually lived, I don't know if he still does, but he did live for a time not far from here in Mapleton. But he would take a bunch of students up to Seattle, Washington. And they did a huge self-report. Like they took like a huge swath of the population. They went up there specifically because of the diversity of faith, diversity of ethnicities. They wanted kind of a large swath of the population that was very diverse.
Okay.
So they started with, I don't know, 5,000 people who sent in these self-report surveys. And then they, by their own, remember, this is their own self-report. So the parents and the children all took these little surveys of how successful they felt and how successful their family was. And they took the ones that scored the highest and they called these their flourishing families. If all the kids and the parents all said, yes, we love our family life, we feel very fulfilled and we're very tight knit, we're close, we're happy. If they all reported that and they got the highest scores, they were picked and selected as a flourishing family. And then it's been going on, I think now almost 40 years. It's been a 40-year long study. And all they wanted to know was, at the beginning, you know, they were kind of biased being Brigham Young University. They were thinking probably if they have a lot of, probably if they're like, if they go to church a lot and stuff, you know, if they have a lot of faith, they'll probably be more successful. But over time, in the first decade, they already realized, no, this is not the case. We have people from all faith backgrounds and some who don't go to church at all. And they're all in the same really flourishing group. So they just wanted to know over time as they kept sending in more surveys, and send them little gift cards for taking the surveys, like what they were doing. And it took them, I think, 15 years of the study to finally have some grad student realize that like what's showing up in this data is that the families who have regular rituals, routines, and traditions, the ones who have the highest number of traditions, rituals, and routines, they were always the ones who scored the highest. And then they said, if this is true, we need to go back and look at the ones who scored the lowest. Like, is there an absence of ritual, routine, tradition? Mm-hmm. And absolutely there was. It was almost, you know, social science is hard to find a perfect correlation.
Right.
But it was almost a perfect correlation.
And these are family units. These aren't individuals.
No, family units.
So you're taking a whole family unit that may not have these positive things, right, traditions, everything, and vice versa.
Yep. So why might faith help in a way? I know statistically, if you share a faith with your spouse, for example, you're 15% more or less, you're 50% more likely to stay together long term. But that could also mean because you were raised in a similar environment. Like, there's a million reasons for why you share a faith.
Yeah.
But all that didn't show up in the data with the families. What showed up was that so long as these families, regardless of whether they had faith or no faith at all, as long as they had a lot of rituals, routines, and traditions, they thrived at the same rate as someone who was very religious. And so religion might help support your rituals, routines, and traditions, and wherein people derive a lot of meaning out of those rituals, routines, and traditions that, say, a church could provide, it helps them in that respect. But I've come to see as a chaplain over time, but it is not religion itself wherein people derive meaning. That just helps support them in their spiritual journey. Religion can be helpful to spirituality, but if you're only getting the negative consequences out of a religion by two, then it can be very negative.
Right.
So a lot of times people will say, well, I check all the boxes. I go to church. I read my scriptures. I say my prayers. Why am I so miserable?
Yeah.
And as a child, I'm like, well, are you even engaged in spirituality? I mean, because going to church doesn't mean you're a spiritual.
You're just checking boxes.
That's right. It means you might be going through the motions, but that doesn't mean you're actually deriving deep meaning and connection from it with others and with some sense of the divine, right?
Gotcha.
So, again, that's all to me the spirituality versus religiosity. But to answer your question, from the time kids are really little, the most powerful thing fathers can do specifically is what they call floor time. Dr. Robinson, he was famous for a little while because he's one of the professors, one of the authors of studies that got correlated with the movie Mean Girls, if you remember back like in the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe even early 2000s. I can't remember when that came out.
2000.
Early 2000s. But his studies showed that regular daily floor time, when dads would literally, they call it floor time because most often it ends up on the floor with the kids, wrestling or something. But something that you're doing every day with kids that's pretty organic and casual, it's not even formal, but it happens daily, is far more impactful on children, especially from the dads, than, say, the Disneyland dads who take their kids to Disneyland once a year or give them a gift on their birthdays that's amazing, but then otherwise spend very little time with them. So daily floor time has the most positive impact on kids from the father's point of view. And people don't realize this, but dads are really, really, really important in kids' emotional regulation. So fathers actually, believe it or not, have been more linked and tied to how kids develop emotionally than even mothers.
I would not expect that.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Because you always think about emotions in mom.
Yeah.
And moms have a huge impact too in other areas of kids' life. But emotional regulation, how kids regulate their emotions and how well they do at regulating their emotions, most of that is derived from their relationship with their dads.
Do you think it's harder for dads that didn't experience that as a kid with their father to then do floor time with their kids?
Absolutely, because if you haven't seen it, it's very hard to duplicate. You have to be what's called a transitional character, where you didn't grow up with something or you didn't learn a skill as a kid from your parents, but then you realize how important it is. Now you have to create it from scratch. Whereas the kids who lucked out to have parents who already did that naturally, it's very easy for them to do it. They don't know what else to do. That they just do what they've seen.
Yeah.
So you can inherit good parenting skills, but to be honest, no one inherits perfect parenting skills. Mm. So all of us at some point should be looking at ourselves saying, where can I be a transitional character and learn from the mistakes? And that's why when I started, I said, you know, I come from a family that I now know was relatively cohesive and functional because my mom coming from the countryside in Canada, you know, she didn't have a degree in family life and she didn't understand the stuff that I understand today. But yeah, parents, that idea of daily floor time with your kids as a father helps them regulate their emotions, helps them feel that sense of security that can reduce anxiety. And man, we have an epidemic of anxiety. But if you look at it too, it's because we also have an epidemic of absentee fathers. Not a lot of fathers are sticking around like they used to. And or they're becoming more involved. I see both. I see that either fathers are getting more and more involved in that role.
Is it kind of a gap?
Yeah.
There's not a lot of middle ground.
It's kind of like the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poor, and there's no middle class. Like more dads are getting, I feel like there's a good number of dads who are getting better at parenting and are taking that role more serious than any generation has ever taken it. Mm-hmm. Gosh, we have more stay-at-home dads now statistically than we ever had too. And a lot of that has to do with women's earnings and the workplace, but frankly, that's not a bad thing. It's the bad thing is that we also on the other extreme have more and more absentee fathers than ever before.
So when you say absentee, my mind goes, it's not just the dad that walks out on his family. It's the dad that's not there emotionally.
That's right. That's right. It doesn't mean necessarily, it can mean that. Yes, absolutely. We have those that are just leaving the family, but it also can just mean the father who completely turned off emotionally, doesn't even know how to raise a child and decided I'm just better at work. Mm-hmm. And they are dedicating themselves to everything but their children.
They justify it like I'm providing.
That's right.
I'm the provider.
And not only that, but look, I'm thriving in the workplace. You know, I might work 20-hour days, but I'm look how wealthy we're getting and so forth, and they're just not there.
Man,
the Disneyland dads, right? Because they know they can pay for Disneyland trips. They know they can come home and give their kid a great birthday.
Right.
But science shows that is not what does it for kids. In fact, it can really complicate their emotions and their relationships in the future because they're not learning that daily emotional regulation from dad and they're not feeling that security every day. So they're just, they have this really, when it rains, it pours mentality. And then they withdraw and the emotional cutoff most of the rest of the time. So imagine how hard that is to live with if you're married to someone who is kind of like bipolar in their emotional regulation, right?
Yeah. I read a quote the other day that said, the only people that remember your late nights worked are your kids.
Hey, there you go. I love that quote. I love that.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely true. It couldn't be more true. You won't even remember them. Someday you're going to be like, why the heck did I spend all that time at work? You know?
Yeah.
But your kids will. In fact, I read a letter from a son of a family yesterday, literally yesterday, that said that very thing. Like, here are all the great things about my family growing up. I'm helping a family put together a little book right now. And one of their sons responded talking about, and one of the questions we asked to all the kids in that family was, what was the hardest thing for you growing up? And he mentioned a time that he remembered his dad being in the military had to be gone. He said, I only remember this time because he was such a good dad when he was there. He was always there. He was always there for us. But man, when he was gone, he's like, I really struggled. He said, I only remember that because he was always there. But then he said, but as I've grown up, I've realized, imagine if that period of time in his life, which was like a year deployment, right, was like other kids' whole entire upbringing.
Yeah.
And he really pointed out in that letter that like, when I think of military kids, sometimes when their dads are just gone emotionally, like they're not even there for them, even when they are home. Like his letter was basically saying, like, I can't imagine what it'd be like to be raised in a family where the father was either physically gone more than ever, or just emotionally not available because his dad was always there for him. But yeah, it's an important thing to realize, like, fathers have a huge effect on their kids' emotional regulation and the outcome of that. And you might think, oh, moms, they do that more naturally. They want to be involved. They tend to gravitate towards focusing more on their kids' emotions.
Right.
But believe it or not, that's not where they derive their sense of emotional regulation. It's from dads.
So it's, I almost feel this weight hearing all this, like, because you don't want to mess your kids up too much, right? I mean, we're going to no matter what, but there's this great sense of responsibility that I feel. And I see it as I cannot do that well until I take care of myself first.
Yeah.
What are some things that dads are not doing or can do better to make sure they're emotionally ready to provide for their kids?
Believe it or not, it's actually quite serendipitous that the things dads need to be well actually are mostly found in time with their kids.
Okay.
What dads need to be well are I don't know, there's an incredible line of thought in the social science world. And it used to be an old form of therapy that was very popular. And I still love it and love to think about it and talk about it. But when you think about the line of thought is called transactional analysis. And the whole concept of transactional analysis is getting people in their adulthood to recognize and realize that everything they got out of touch with from their childhood is actually where they're held up. So being in touch with the inner child.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
Yeah. Okay, you've heard, that's the more popular way of expressing it. Uh-huh. All that comes from transactional analysis.
Okay.
And this was really popular in like the 70s and 80s, right? But that inner child, you can actually find that portion in almost every type of clinical therapy. And almost everyone that I've come across, the goal and the point is to get them back in touch with this really sensitive emotional part of themselves where they can process all this really pent up stuff that they've held back over years.
Yeah.
Well, guess who brings that out more than anyone? Children.
Yeah, being around them.
That's it. So if you engage with your kids, believe it or not, it's probably the most therapeutic thing dads can do. Now, why do we hate it? Because we were raised culturally as men to not engage with our emotions. And so we're not only are we bad at it, but it kind of scares us because we're bad at it.
Yeah, being that vulnerable.
That's right.
It's scary.
Vulnerability. But you know what? I love that word vulnerability, not because it's popular, not because right now it's kind of a trending topic on YouTube, but like the word vulnerability comes from ancient Latin. The word in Latin that we derived that word from is vulnus or vulne, which means to wound. To wound. So when we say our vulnerability, we're actually saying our woundability. Like, how good are we at being wounded for another human being?
Wow.
Isn't that awesome? So I say to dads, hey, it might hurt. It might hurt to go out there and put yourself out there emotionally. And it will be painful for a little while, but only a little while. And then once you realize, like, wow, this actually makes me feel really good, I'm more able to be that inner child when I'm around my kids. And that hurt to do for a little while because I wasn't used to it. But now it's really, really healthy. I think dads who engage with their kids find natural therapy in their children.
That's very interesting. With your line of work, have you ever struggled with like self-doubt? Like I'm trying to help these families, but am I even helping my family? Like stuff like
absolutely.
That. Like, how do you?
Gosh, I was thinking about that on the drive over here tonight. Literally when you realize like you're helping all these other people and you're doing a lot of good stuff in the world, but where do you draw the line and where do you balance out like the fact that your kids are at home right now and you could be spending time with them? And man, you know, when they get up to be in their teenage years, like my kids are, it's tough because they have a social life and they got stuff and now their schedules start to conflict with your schedules. When they were little was when it was quite easy. It's like, well, I know where my kids are every night.
Yeah.
Now it's like, hey, you know, if I don't look carefully at the family calendar, I might even be home one night and they're all gone. And I didn't even realize that was going to happen. And so then there's, you know, one or two nights a week that I have to be gone. And that might be the night they're home. And so it gets trickier to spend time with kids the older they get. But that being said, the guilt of like, yes, like here I am professing all this stuff for people all day long. And then, you know, how well do I live it? Absolutely. I think every father feels that. And if you don't, you don't live in the modern world. But that's honestly another byproduct that I believe came directly out of the techno world. Let's even go back to before TVs. I mean, TVs, you could argue, brought the family together, but it didn't give the kid the process time, the floor time with dad, because now he's focused on something else, right? So ever since the advent of television and then everything that came after, each technological step we've taken has actually separated more and more and more parents from that sort of like, let me tell you a story about my life. Let me talk to you about this hard thing that you went through today at school. Let me tell you about what that was like and when it happened to me. And dads used to process that, I would say, more often, even if they weren't culturally more sensitive. But now, because of technology, a lot of times we just use that phone or computer or screen as like, well, let's just watch this. And then if we all felt good after the Pixar film, then I guess we're all good.
Yeah, no kidding.
And it's like, that's not helping them really attach or bond to you at all. It's just giving them an experience with the television, you know, with the screen.
So. It's such a black hole. Like it can suck you in. It's so easy to just, I'm sitting on the couch and my kid's in the room playing. Let me just hop on Instagram real quick.
Yeah. And now I'm rituals, routines, traditions. Remember, I'm not against, if a family movie night is a tradition weekly, keep it. Because mm-hmm. that's a tradition and that
yeah,
matters.
Yeah.
But when it becomes your default mode, that's when it's a problem. When it becomes your like, okay, well, I don't know what to do right now and I'm busy, so I'm just going to hand to my phone, or I'm going to hand to my screen, or I'm going to sit down on the computer and just get a YouTube video going for them. That default mode is the danger. That's the red flag. Like, why am I defaulting to technology when I could be defaulting to 50 other things that have to do with some better connection? Even if your kids truly, I mean this, a connection with the natural world has proven to be really a resilient factor in kids.
Get outside.
That's right. Yeah. And if you even gave them a, more of a connection with nature, you'd be doing them a way bigger favor than any time you could give them in the tech world.
Yeah.
That, you know, the countries, the Nordic countries, okay, those Northern, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, they start their kids in the maths and sciences way later than we do. I think the age is like 8. We start them from the time they go into kindergarten and first grade. But why do they delay? Because that whole first years of development, they believe that a connection with nature is imperative to their long-term mental health. So they put them through what they call forest school before they'll even put them into academic school.
I've heard of like homeschooling.
That's right.
Adopting this.
But forest school is just this concept where kids get to go out and with supervision, explore the natural world and bond with it every day. But in so doing, they're also bonding with their peers. So then they develop social skills naturally. They develop the forest skills naturally. And all the studies coming out of those schools have been just top notch for the kids' emotional resilience and well-being. And then later they worry about the academics. Because to be honest, it doesn't matter whether your kid's reading in preschool or not. Every study's shown that if they pick that up young, it doesn't even affect them by fourth and fifth grade. They're right on par with everyone else who didn't start that young. So there's something about when those academic skills can even come online. But what we're missing in our society is more of the social emotional development. And so my wife and I are huge. We both have degrees in family life. My wife's got her degree in family life as well. And everything we've studied has showed us that, that social and emotional development at a young age, which has to do with how well parents are interacting with their kids on a daily basis. That is far greater predictor of future success, even in school, than any academics. Mm-hmm. So lay off the academics, they'll get it, it'll come.
Yeah.
Really lean into the social and emotional development of your kids.
I love that.
Yep.
I think the parents need to get outside anyway too.
Yeah.
A lot more, right?
But why have academics become so big? Honestly, social media, I think that's why. Because if someone posts a video of their like 2-year-old reading,
oh gosh,
then everyone's like, well, gosh, what's wrong with my 2-year-old? And the answer is nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing at all. In fact, that 2-year-old that's reading on that screen that looks amazing right now, and when he's in fourth or fifth grade with your 2-year-old, they will be on the same exact level.
Hmm.
It's just that certain systems come online for different kids at different times. But academia is not the most important part of development before age 7. It's all about emotional and social development.
What's a lesson that you've learned in your career path that has just surprised you?
Surprised me. I think the single, maybe one of the single most surprising things that I've learned, I guess one of them had to do with the early, in like maybe 10, 15 years ago when we started to realize just how prominent loneliness, before the pandemic, before COVID, there was actually this huge, already pre-existing pandemic of loneliness. And then COVID hit, right? So of course we have mental health issues because we had loneliness, now we got it on steroids. But I guess it surprised me to realize just how many people truly report feeling lonely, even people in relationships and even people in families.
They're reporting this.
That's right.
Because in my mind is like, how lonely do you have to be to actually tell someone you're lonely?
That's right.
And that's scary.
That's right. So those numbers, I guess, shocked me because I still think I was at some degree believing that like, technology is connecting people. Technology is allowing people to meet more friends and do more things. But in reality, even sexuality, for example, how often people engage in sex with each other dropped during the period preceding COVID. Like those levels were tanking off long before the COVID shut them off completely. And so if you think about it, like the engagement that people were doing socially was already a problem. And now with COVID, it just became an even worse habit of just. So we have these epidemic of loneliness. And I think that was shocking to me. I don't know why it surprised me when I first saw the numbers and the data on that, because to me, I guess I thought, well, technology's not doing a great job, but I think it's doing an okay job. And now I realize, no, it's doing a terrible job. We really do have a problem. We've got to draw ourselves back from this like addiction to tech that we have and somehow do it in a way that doesn't completely negatively affect every facet of our society, because now it's all governed by that technology. So I'm not sure how it'll happen. I'm not proposing that we all go back to forest school or anything, but I just feel like we need to, as individuals, I think that's where it starts, as individual families, just say like, okay, we're going to vastly restrict our family's tech time and then use it only for the things we know it really does help our family with. Like, for example, if this is your career, that's important, right?
Yeah.
So work on it during the time that you would work on a career, but otherwise, you know, keep that at a distance from your family. Otherwise, you're going to end up in those same loneliness numbers that the world is experiencing right now, like crazy.
Yeah.
And the only countries who aren't, by the way, are those who really already have regulation in place that does restrict technology. They're doing better socially. So,
well, it makes sense. If I'm going to self-analyze how I am doing as a father and husband, what are some questions that I need to ask myself?
Self-analysis, man, that can be one of my favorite theologians once said that to be careful to not get caught in what he called soul-sickening self-examination, because oftentimes when we get in our head and we get too analytical about our performance in any facet of life, that's actually when we do the worst. What you want to do is actually get in the habit of shutting off more often this prefrontal cortex right here that has to do with all that analysis and logic and reason. And actually, that's when people do their very best. So it's kind of like, think of a basketball player shooting free throws, and he could hit them all day long when he's by himself on a court. Mm-hmm. But then as soon as you say, hey, if you make this one, you get $1 million.
Yeah.
Suddenly there's like this added pressure. There's this added like anxiety. And believe it or not, under pressure, the pressure shots in history at the free throw line even have been the most missed shots. Even with people who have like 80, 90% free throw percentage. And that's only because when you add this layer of like self-consciousness and you're over-analyzing with your prefrontal cortex all your performance and what you do, that's when the anxiety kicks in. That's when you start to not be able to function as well. So question, how do you shut off your prefrontal cortex? Quite honestly, the best things we have for that are meditation. Just daily, what they call mindfulness meditation. Mm-hmm. Just breathing techniques. Time where you sit or go out in nature and think of nothing. And suddenly what they've shown is that all the neurochemicals that start to like calm and quiet your self-analysis and all that negative self-feedback or like, how good am I doing this? They shut off in your performance levels in almost everything, your ability to concentrate, your ability to do what you do well and not think about it. All of that increases. And so I don't think it's a question for me of how do we do better at analyzing ourselves to get better. I think it's how do we unplug? And I don't mean that technologically now. I mean it like physiologically. How do we get to a place where we have a lot more calm in our life so that we aren't self-analyzing all the time? Because the daily grind is what makes us really soul-sickening self-examination. Mm-hmm. The daily grind is what gets us running after, like, how well am I doing at my job? How well am I raising my kids? You know, and that can be a really bad mental habit instead of just being with kids.
So I guess instead of self-analyzing, shut it down and don't worry about it.
That's right. Believe it or not, that has better outcomes.
So how do I know that I'm doing a good job?
Well, you know when you know, right? I mean, if you know you have a good relationship with your kids and you feel that they are close to you as well and they share things with you and they love to hug you and squeeze you and they're asking to spend time with you on a daily basis, you're doing it. But I've seen people who try to make like, okay, how much time have I spent with my kids this week and start writing it all down and stuff like that, trying to prep for a marathon. And it's just, even if it did increase the time you spent with your kids, I would think that it would put you in a mindset that wasn't as focused or connected with your kids because you're like, it's kind of like what we said about going to church. It becomes like, you're just checking a box. If you're checking a box, you're not really engaged with your kids. It's a mindset. It's a mindset shift that we have to have. And it's not a goal that we can achieve. You know, I'm not sure I could say that I even know how many hours a week I spend with my kids, but I know I spend time with my kids every day. And why? Because I think about doing that every day.
Yeah.
It's a mindset. And it's a priority, but that doesn't mean I know exactly how many hours. And there's days I'm sure I spend a lot less than other days.
Yeah.
But I don't worry about that. And what I know is that my kids and I are close. And when I feel even a slight shift in that, like last year I did, I felt with one of my daughters, my middle daughter, I felt a little shift. There was just this little, this is not quite like it was. So just to make sure, I waited a day or two and thought, if it changes, maybe it's just something that happened at school or something. And it didn't change for 2 or 3 days. And I could sense it. It was just a little different. Something was off. So I finally went to her and asked and said, then, man, anything going on? You still seem like yourself, right? And what really had happened was that she'd had this big thing with a test at school that got her in trouble with the teacher, and she's not someone who gets in trouble very often because some friend had suggested that they use ChatGPT to end a paper, and she didn't want to tell us that because she felt bad, but it wasn't her fault. And so we said, hey, you know what? We can help with that. And I wouldn't have – that was such a minor shift in her behavior that I really believe if my wife and I didn't spend regular time with her, I would have never picked up on that.
Yeah.
My wife agreed, by the way. I mean, I consoled with her and said, don't you think she's been a little odd lately? And she's like, yeah, I agree. So, you know, it's good to get feedback if you've got a good partner. But if you're doing it on your own, like, look, you know when your kids are a little different. But you don't know if you haven't spent time with them every day. And I think that's where parents sometimes are just like, well, I didn't see that coming. And it usually means like, well, maybe you were with them every day. Maybe you were at the house with them every day, but were you really with them every day?
Yeah.
And it's a very different thing to be with your kids, not just at home.
So are there any questions I need to be asking or any pieces of information you can share with me about fatherhood that we haven't hit on yet? Any little knowledge nuggets?
So fatherhood is hard if you don't have a good relationship. So for those married to a woman, let me say this. Men tell each other things and they talk about things like we are right now to try to find solutions to problems in their life and fix them.
Yeah.
And that's why a man talks to a man. That's why a man admires a man for any reason. Like, hey, he's got something going on I want going on in my life, so I'm going to ask him. We're going to talk about it, and we're going to solve that problem. Women don't talk about their problems for that reason. They talk about problems to relate to another human being and connect to them. So I know this sounds cliche, and you hear it all the time, but I can't reiterate. If you're struggling as a man in a relationship, then you're going to be struggling as a father. Because if you don't have your needs met, right, which is comes primarily through that relationship with your spouse, then of course you're not going to be emotionally available for your kids. And the first thing, it's very counterintuitive, but I'm telling you, like, it'll help a ton. The first thing fathers can do to be better fathers is be better husbands to their wives, and that involves the skill of listening. Not even telling them what's wrong, not telling them their problem and how to fix it, not trying to correct them every day. I know so many dads who just spend so much time correcting their spouse, and I'm guilty of that too. I'm totally guilty of like getting into that mode where I'm just telling my wife, hey, I think we could do this better. I think we could do that better. I think if you did this and that, you know, the kids would be doing better. But that's because we're very analytical as men, and we analyze everything and we just want to fix it. But women want to relate So they talk to people about their problems, not to find solutions to their problems, believe it or not, but to relate to someone else about the same problem. So if your wife comes home one day and tells you how hard her day was, don't tell her how she can like do 50 things to fix it. Tell her, hey, I've been there. I've done that. Like I know what it feels like to have an out of control day and to not feel like I'm as organized as I want to be, or I didn't get that much done, or that the kids, you know, threw up and it was disgusting and I felt really alone, right? Like you just have to relate to that. And the better you relate in conversations to your wife, the more you're going to get your needs met. And when you have your needs met, you can be there for your kids. So it's a very counterintuitive process to actually say less and listen more. But I'm telling you, that's the first step to great fatherhood, because it's the first step to a great relationship. And that's vital to your ability to be a dad.
Awesome. I love it. Yeah. And it's the answer we may not want to hear, man.
That's right. That's right.
To listen more, but just we've heard it before more. And we're going to have to air it in, right?
Get really good at just listening on a therapeutic level. Chaplains call it holy listening or sacred listening. You're listening so well that just from listening to another human being, they're like, man, I feel really good right now. And you'll shock the heck out of them, by the way, too, if you do this, because we all know we're not good at it. And so The minute you sit down and actually say, hey, just tell me about your day. I'm just here to listen. That's all I'm here to do, you know. And then you actually listen, they're going to be like, man, it'll shift the whole dynamic. And if you get really good at it, again, doing it once is not a thing. That's like Disneyland, Dad. Mm-hmm. You got to get good at doing it almost every day. But it doesn't take that long either, you know. They don't want it. I know it's hard to listen sometimes. Men don't hear women with the same part of their brain that women hear men with, believe it or not.
Yeah.
So men hear women's voices like in the same part of their brain as music. And that's why when women speak, sometimes we can quickly go to listening to the sound of their voice without thinking about it. And we don't actually get the logical sequence of the words that they're saying. But women don't have that problem. They hear men's voice with the logical part of their brain. The same part of the brain that men hear other men's voices from. And so it's a very strange thing that it is easier for men not to hear women because they process it with a different artistic part of their brain. But that being said, you got to get good at listening to the logical sequential what your wife is saying to you so that she feels heard and understood. And in that moment, you'll realize, oh, it doesn't take forever to connect with my wife. It just takes a really good listening ear. And then you can be amazing with kids because you feel like she's happy. Now you're happier. And now because you both feel better, it's just so much easier to engage with the kids. Because, you know, when you're fighting or she's mad or you're mad, it doesn't matter. It ruins the whole dynamic. And neither one of you are good parents at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts with the nucleus, right? And you two are the nucleus of that whole nuclear system. And if the nucleus is not healthy, then parenting becomes very difficult. So focus on your relationship, and I promise parenting will come. But a lot of people focus on parenting to the detriment of their own relationship. And then they wonder why, well, what happened to our kids?
Isn't divorce rate higher when one's kids are out of the home?
Yes. There's three big spikes in divorce rate. The first one is the first year of marriage. Believe it or not, if you survive the first year of marriage, you're already ahead of the statistical game. Because most divorces that take place in the first year. Then there's another second spike, but it's not as big as the first year, but it comes after the first baby. Mm-hmm. So when, for the first time, you actually have to become parents to a child, that can introduce that's when a lot of people realize how different their upbringing was and how different their families were.
It magnifies
your relationship. That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
But the third spike in divorce doesn't come till way after. And it's the only other big spike in divorce rate. And it happens at the empty nest. So if you spent all those years growing apart, she's been doing her thing, you've been doing your thing. And again, and they haven't been focusing on the relationship because they've been focusing on being such good parents. Then, and it's the saddest kind of divorce I've seen in a counseling office, frankly. And I've seen a lot of them. Because they spent 20, 25, 30 years together.
Yeah.
And now they don't even care about each other. Yeah. And it was because they were trying so hard to make life good for their kids that they forgot to make life good for each other. And And then it didn't matter. And by the way, if you think, well, it wouldn't matter, the kids are all grown by then. No, they, it affects them just as much in adulthood as it does. As it, almost, I shouldn't say that. The worst, you know, the younger kids are, yes, the harder it is, and it affects their whole life. But it still very much affects children who are adults whose parents divorce. Right. And it affects the likelihood that they'll get divorced as well.
Okay.
So don't think that it doesn't matter if, well, we'll just stay together till the kids are gone. It's like, well, you're still going to affect them negatively. And I'm not saying stay together at all costs if you're in a toxic relationship or you're in an abusive relationship. I mean, those are all reasons to definitely leave and get help. But where you know it's just something that you just haven't worked out between
right.
you two,
right.
you got to focus on that before you can be good parents. Because if you're not good, then there's no way you're going to be good parents.
Yeah. I can't think of a better way to practice listening than being a podcast host. Right?
Yeah,
so maybe the whole purpose of this podcast is to just practice listening.
Honestly, if you took your wife down here and put her in front of this microphone every day yeah. and you said, hey, tell me about your day. I just want to record it. She would, man, you guys would have the perfect relationship.
You know, the other week she's like, why haven't you had me on the podcast?
So there
I'm
you
like,
go, see?
I got to practice more. I'm not there yet.
That's it. That's all they want. And it took me years to realize. I mean, I'd studied that. I'd read that. I'd heard that. But it took me years to realize how true it was. Like women, I think the most confusing thing to guys about their wives is that they don't talk about problems to fix problems. They can. It's not that they're incapable of it. They go to work every day and talk about problems and fix problems every day. I'm not saying that women are incapable of that. But when they talk to you as a significant other, as a deeply connected relationship, what they want is for you to relate to their problems. They don't want you to solve their problems. And men step into that problem every day.
Yeah.
Every day, some guy comes home, thousands of men come home every day, and their wives are like, hey, let me tell you what happened. And all they're trying to say to you is, I need you to relate to me right now. I need you to feel what I'm feeling and connect on a spiritual level, right? But men step in it every day because they're like, oh, I know what to do. We can do this.
They're like going to caveman.
That's it. Yeah. Or they run off and go into their man cave and don't even listen.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
One way or another, they're either trying to fix the problem, which is not what she wants, and makes her feel like you're critical of her. Or they run off and say, I can't take this right now. I'm going to go do some man cave time. And because they get into the habit of feeling like, when I come home, my wife throws all these problems on my feet.
Yeah.
And she's not actually trying to throw them at your feet either, by the way. She's just trying to connect with you. And so don't think that when she tells you, see, because that's the problem. A man says, if a man says, hey, guess what happened today? This was a problem. The expectation is he wants me to solve it right now for him.
Yeah.
She doesn't, I promise. You don't even have to worry about coming up with a solution. She doesn't want it. What she wants is connection in that moment. And men fear that they need to be the ones with the answers. They think, well, she wants me to solve this problem right now. So they get all anxious and then feel like they got to run away from the problem to their man cave.
Yeah.
But that's not what they want. That's not what they want. They just want a minute of reflection and sort of like, oh man, that's hard. Like I get that. That must have been a really hard day. That's it. And say that about 3 times. Throughout the duration of a 30-minute conversation when you get home, and I promise you, your life will get really good really fast.
Awesome. Yeah. I love it. Well, to wrap up the podcast, I always ask the same question at the end, and that is, if there's one lesson you want to leave with your kids when you're no longer here, what is that lesson?
One lesson. I mean, it changes by the month and the year, I suppose, because we're always changing. But right now, my feeling would definitely be making them realize deeply that, like, they're more capable than anyone ever believes they are. Everybody feels so limited by their life experience or by, well, I didn't grow up in a family that did that. But to be honest with you, everyone feels that way. Insecurity is a very common human thing, even among the most famous of celebrities. Even among the most successful CEOs. As a chaplain, I had access to government leaders and their counseling situations and military top generals of the armed forces who, believe it or not, suffer with these same exact feelings of insecurity. And I would just tell my kids and want them to realize that, like, it's okay. It's totally normal not to believe in yourself naturally. But believe me when I tell you, everyone else feels the same way. So you're just as capable of anything you want to do in life as anyone else. And you don't have to restrict yourself to what you feel like you're good at. You can just say, hey, whatever you want to do, you can do, because the world was created by people who are no more intelligent or capable than you.
Awesome. Yep. Well, thanks for being here and being a guest and sharing your advice and thoughts and experiences.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate it. This has been great.
Awesome.
Thanks.
Okay. Sorry, we went a little over than